KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
The data shows beaver and salmon have coexisted forever. Beaver habitat, beaver dams, salmon, they're symbiotic, and then all these other benefits. So I think we've systematically just been rigorously and as scientifically as possible organizing and addressing the misperceptions in society, specifically in California, around beaver.
There are ranchers in Nevada who are willing to go on record now saying, 20 years ago we used to shoot the beaver, and now we wouldn't have a cattle operation without them. And they're having to save their neighbors who come and literally get water from them and truck it to their operation because they haven't been able to retain the water in the same way as those who have these beaver complexes.
In this episode, Kate Lundquist and Brock Dolman of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center share their semi-aquatic journey to becoming beaver believers. They're part of a passionate global movement to bring back our rodent relatives who show us how to heal nature by working with nature. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Beaver Believers, How to Restore Planet Water. We live on planet water, where water is life. During the past 4.6 billion years or so of Earth history, we've had water for about 4 billion years. 70% of Earth's surface is water. Water has carved and sculpted the landscape in a dance among geology, hydrology, and biology. Our bodies are mostly water. Try living without it sometime. As the iconic ecologist Aldo Leopold's son Luna Leopold put it, the health of our waters is the principal measure of how we live on the land. You'd think that by now we'd have learned to cherish water and think like a watershed. To the contrary, as the species that is the greatest degenerative disturber of our surroundings, we've commodified, trashed, and wasted water like there's no tomorrow. Now that there may be no tomorrow, unless we radically change our ways of living on planet water, we can turn for solutions to that other famously busy, regenerative disturber of its surroundings, cousin beaver. In this age of global weirding, where climate disruption has tumbled the Goldilocks effect into unruly surges of too much and too little water, the restoration of beavers offers ancient nature-based solutions to the tangle of challenges bedeviling human civilization. Droughts, floods, soil erosion, climate change, biodiversity loss, you name it, and beaver is on it. So let's begin at the beginning. Who is cousin beaver anyway?
So we're really talking about the North American beaver, which is Castor canadensis. They are rodents. So a colony could be 5 to 12 individuals. Beavers slow water, irrigate the land to grow vegetation, to grow themselves food, and make a pond deep enough that they can escape predation. Mountain lions, for instance, like deep beavers. They're forest farmers. They're going to have a main dam where they live in their house, whether that's a stick house out in the middle like a little island or burrowed into the bank. And that's where they spend their daytimes, mostly inside the lodge. They are protected in there. It's cozy and warm in there. They get to hang out and groom, and they might emerge out at sunset. They're going to go work on the dams, patch things up. They're managing water, they're socializing, they're marking territory, and then they may go harvest food. They're just busy as beavers.
Brock Dolman co-founded the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Sonoma County, California, where he co-directs its Water Institute, Permaculture Design Program, and Wildlands Program. He's consulted on regenerative project design and implementation internationally. Along with Brock, Kate Lundquist co-directs the center's Water Institute, as well as its Bring Back the Beaver campaign. She's a conservationist, educator, ecological artist, and wildland tender.
So they go as high up as the taiga, and now with the melting of the Arctic, they are moving into the Arctic as well, and there's been a lot of press about that. Beavers are ruining the Arctic. Actually, I don't think it was beavers that burned all that carbon that is now melting the Arctic, so we got to cut them a little slack. They're just adaptable and taking advantage of that habitat that's being freed up, and they go down as far as the Sonoran Desert. They have these incredible adaptations that make them really, really capable of being in the water a lot. They have these paddled feet so they can swim. They have the tail that is also really good for helping propel themselves in the water. They regulate their body temperature through their tails as well. They have this really cool specialized toe. They need to groom themselves to keep their fur waterproof so that they can stay warm in the water and stay dry when they get out. And they have these incisors that are super key to their ability to cut down the trees and to peel the bark and do all of the incredible engineering work that they do. And they're unusual as a rodent. Beavers only have one set of kits every year. They keep the young around for up to 3 years, training them in all the skills of being a beaver, living together, and doing this work collectively.
Beaver is a keystone species. Keystone is the architectural term for the stone at the top of an arch that holds it in place. Remove it and the arch collapses. In other words, beavers disproportionately benefit many natural processes, which in turn support countless other species, including us humans. It's all about managing life-giving water, for which they are uniquely fitted. Beavers are crucial for water conservation. Their dams slow water down and spread it out, creating lush wetlands while recharging groundwater. They store water against droughts. They prevent violent flooding. They create fire breaks against the now common firenadoes that have beset California and the western states. They create habitat for countless other species, from fish and turtles to birds. The list goes on.
What those dams end up doing is they act like these sieves. So when you have these floods that are delivering nutrients or sediments, they're trapping all of that. And the study that was done in 2007 demonstrated that the dams were trapping phosphorus, which is actually a contaminant and causes poor water quality. They end up buffering many of the impacts that happen with the climate changes that we're experiencing right now. And so multiple dams, they end up being like speed bumps. And so you get these high flow events coming in, and it helps slow that water down, shunt it off onto the floodplain, and then basically distribute the energy and de-escalate that energy that comes in with those floodwaters. But then similarly, in a drought situation, they're holding that water and keeping it there longer on the landscape into the dry season.
As environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb illustrates in his book, Eager, we need to reconfigure our historical conception of what a healthy riverscape looks like. Not every stream fits our English countryside-inspired vision of an idyllic mountain brook, free-flowing, fast-moving, and gravel-bottomed. Instead, across the continent, beavers created complex, multi-threaded webs of water, patched with swampy wetlands that also build soil and sequestered carbon. Goldfarb estimates that pre-contact North America beaver dams may have impounded an additional 230,000 square miles of water. That's the size of Arizona and Nevada. Although wetlands comprise just 2% of land area, they support 80% of biodiversity.
Beavers will dig
entire canal systems out to their favorite food sources, especially if it's like willow thicket. You'll see this a lot in Sierra meadows where they've dammed up the stream in the meadow, and that's created a big wetted area behind the dam. But then there's these aspen stands, and they love aspen. That's one of their favorite foods. They will risk their lives for aspen. And so for them, digging these canals to get to those aspen groves so that they can fell the trees and cut them up, get the bark, get the leaves, and then drag what they want back through these canal systems. But ideally, you find these areas where beavers have been living there for generations, and so they just inherit the work of the former colony of their ancestors, and they get to build on it. And it creates these just amazing expanses of wetlands, and some areas will have younger trees because the beaver harvested those, and then other areas will have more mature trees, and it just creates this beautiful mosaic.
Think of it as a vast hospitality enterprise, an all-you-can-eat-and-drink buffet for the neighborhood. As Goldfarb puts it, the list of organisms that benefit from beavers is basically a list of organisms in North America. In their relentless drive to change their surroundings, beavers are creating conditions conducive to a riotous diversity of life. Northern California's Smith River, which is the last mighty undammed river of its size in California, is a case in point. Again, Brock Dolman.
It's a system too big for the beavers to dam across. It's too deep and too wide. And the beavers are like, there's plenty of water. We don't need to dam up, right? So what they do is they'll dig a burrow into the bank, and folks got their snorkel gear on, and they would like snorkel up into these little like bank caves and stick their head up into the entrance of this bank burrow and look at all the critters in there, and then see all of this wood. Like after the beavers chew off all the bark, and we call it corn on the cob, like you take a willow stick and you strip off that bark, that's what they're eating, is the cambium layer. Then the stick is either just used there, and they pile up outside of these. And these folks coined this idea that they were called river reefs. So the bank lodge, inside the entrance to the bank burrow, they found all kind of coho salmon and steelhead hiding out in there. And then on all those sticks, they found all these types of native critters that were using this complexity, like a coral reef. These they were calling river reefs. And it was the three-dimensional heterogeneity, the complexity that the beavers created in their refuse pile that increased the carrying capacity, create conditions conducive for life for Castor canadensis, right? And so they're super cool that way.
Along the Feather River that originates in the Sierra Nevada mountains, a group doing water restoration work discovered sticks that beavers, dating back to around 580 AD, had chewed on. These aquatic creatures had created a landscape of lush mountain meadows over a 1,200-year timeline. Pre-contact in 1491, before European settlers arrived in North America, there were as many as 400 million beavers on the continent, compared to today's 10 or 15 million. Lewis and Clark describe beaver dams as far as the eye could see, up every tributary of the Missouri Basin. This was well known to the millions of First Peoples of North America. Beaver was a revered totem animal for numerous tribes across the continent. However, as the Haudenosaunee put it, what your people call resources, our people call relatives. The European settlers saw this revered creature only as a valuable commodity.
Beavers, unfortunately, made really good hats, and their castoreum gland has a scent to it that was used for perfumes and flavorings and all kinds of things. And really the arrival and the driver of settlement in North America, starting way back in the Northeast in the 1500s and 1600s, was the push for beaver fur. But we also had the Russians working the coast of Sonoma County and Mendocino and Marin County in the late 1700s, sea otter, fur seals, but also trading for beaver or any other fur they could get in the inland as well. And that process drove beavers to near extinction.
After the fur rush came the devastating gold rush that resulted in another beaver massacre. Subsequently, settlers removed beavers to drain the wetlands for agriculture and cattle grazing. the beavers had created rich carbon-laden soil for farmers to exploit. By the early 1900s, there were fewer than 1,000 beavers in California. The meadows dehydrated, dry land plants disappeared, lodgepole pines invaded, and after the 1850s, the landscape became more arid. Then came the sheep, who overgrazed what was left. By 1911, the state of California tried to reverse the damage and passed a law to protect beavers.
And then the government of the Division of Wildlife, that was called then, it's now California Department of Fish and Wildlife, actually engaged in a process of relocating beavers. And California relocated about 1,200 beavers, more than any other western state by a long shot. In Idaho in 1948, they started parachuting beavers out of planes, and they had Geronimo the beaver, who they dropped to figure out the mechanism on this parachute box when it landed so it would open up and beaver and Geronimo could walk away. But California, not to be outdone, we had our own beaver parachuting campaign in 1950 into the El Dorado National Forest up kind of Echo Summit, south of Tahoe, if people know that part of the world. And they did that, imagine, because beaver dams in the mountains save water for fish, wildlife, and agriculture.
But by the 1950s, the various agencies, fisheries, and biologists became less interested in restoring beaver populations. Some said beavers were bad for salmon, blocking their passage in rivers. Others claimed the beavers weren't native to California and were put there only when states were moving beavers around. Perhaps most of all, they complained beavers were a major nuisance to human affairs. Brock Dolman and Kate Lundquist co-published with a number of other authors two peer-reviewed papers in the California Fish and Game Journal that looked at the historic range of beaver in both the Sierra Nevada and the coastal areas of California. They worked with colleagues to gather evidence that indicates beaver are native to much of California.
And the result of those papers is that was a shift in the perception, I think. The data shows beaver and salmon have coexisted forever. Beaver habitat, beaver dams, salmon, they're symbiotic, and then all these other benefits. So I think we've systematically just been rigorously and as scientifically as possible organizing and addressing the misperceptions in society, specifically in California, around beaver. And then what is possible with respect to how to coexist with this very large rodent, 60, 70, 80-pound rodent with really big teeth that chews down trees and builds dams and floods things and does amazing stuff. But if that's your driveway or that was your favorite tree or your vineyard, you might not be so happy, or your culvert. So thankfully, there's a lot of affordable, accessible, non-lethal coexistence strategies to live with the beaver and get the benefits of the beaver.
Although today's beaver populations of about 10 to 15 million are a small fraction of their former glory, they are a relative success story in the restoration of an endangered species. However, there's no doubt beavers can be a serious nuisance for human activities. So the question becomes, how can we learn to live with beavers? Because we can't live without them. More when we return. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts, check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most, and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. Indeed, beavers can present serious disruptions to human endeavors. Consequently, Brock Dolman and Kate Lundquist are supporting farmers, landowners, and others who are frustrated by busy beavers that mess with their waterways and agricultural lands. They say that human ingenuity, combined with beaver mimicry, is yielding a beaver peace treaty using non-lethal strategies to both peacefully coexist and partner with beavers. Again, Kate Lundquist.
We really want to ideally keep the beaver where they are if we can, because that's going to be the easiest for the beaver, also the easiest for us. Trapping and killing beaver is actually economically not sustainable. They just keep coming back if you have the good habitat and the water. So figuring out ways to fence them out totally works. You can protect your levees and culverts so they aren't going to dig into them. You can put a pipe through a beaver dam, and you can set the water level that you want that pond to be at. High enough so the beaver sticks around and you get all the benefits, but low enough that it's not going to flood your property. And we've been putting in these devices all over. We've been working with water agencies, community service districts, Caltrans, bunch of different agencies, and these are really cost-effective, simple ways, time-tested. They've been utilized. There's certain states where you can't trap beaver, and the departments of transportation there have to use these devices. And so we're working with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to rethink their guidance on how they give their permits for landowners to kill beaver. And so what we really want to make sure is that those landowners are given all of the support that they need to implement these non-lethal strategies first before they resort to killing. And hopefully it can be a win-win for everyone, that the beaver get to stick around, the landowner gets the support they need, and we still get the beneficial habitat and water resources that the beaver can help provide.
California is the most hydrologically altered state in the union. Much, if not most, of that design is ecologically illiterate. Climate disruption is causing a systemic stress test. This collision between the state of nature and the nature of the state presents game-changing opportunities to improve our human relationship with water and land by improving our relations with beaver.
We work in a lot of different areas of California, so starting at the ridgeline, and really focusing on our montane meadows in particular, because those places act as sponges. And in an era of decreasing snowpack, we really need to invest in restoring those meadows and making sure that they can retain as much water that falls on them later into the season. And so there's already a huge movement of folks doing this restoration work in mountain meadows, and we really help bring the beaver to that conversation. A big part of this is beaver mimicry as well. So putting in these structures in the stream that goes through these meadows that mimic beaver dams. We're doing a lot of this work, especially in areas where fires have come through, and there's a lot of sediment now being delivered and ash and whatnot. We're working with ranchers and riparian rangelands. It's amazing how the perception of beaver has been evolving in the West. You know, there are ranchers in Nevada who have been at beaver restoration longer than those in California who are willing to go on record now saying 20 years ago we used to shoot the beaver and now we wouldn't have a cattle operation without them. And they're having to save their neighbors who come and literally get water from them and truck it to their operation because they haven't been able to retain the water in the same way as those who have these beaver complexes.
Other ranchers are having similar experiences that are making them beaver believers. Meanwhile, several California Native American tribes are working to bring back the beaver. Within sight of the spot where the Tule River tribe is preparing for its homecoming is a 3-foot-long beaver pictograph. It's estimated to be 500 to 1,000 years old.
They don't have beaver right now, and because they're a sovereign nation, the department had no legal standing to refuse their desire to restore beaver, and so they were saying, sure, we'll help you find the beaver, test the beaver, quarantine, and deliver you the beaver, which is like, huh, that's good. And so we're, in the meantime, really trying to set the stage of making good habitat, and so we got to work with the Tribal Natural Resources Department and just do this amazing collaboration of thinning fuel loads, so taking out a lot of these extra fuels, limbing and thinning, and then stuffing them in the creek and really trapping the sediment.
Thanks to the work of the Bring Back the Beaver campaign and other advocates across the state, beaver restoration is taking root in riparian rangelands. National wildlife refuges, and the Central Valley Duck Clubs and rice-growing fields. It's also infiltrating urban areas. In downtown Napa, the mayor issued a formal beaver welcome proclamation. In San Luis Obispo, they formed a beaver brigade. The town of Martinez annually hosts a wildly popular beaver festival and parade.
Something that could take decades, we can actually put in structures and work with the beaver and accelerate it to happen within a decade and restore these wetlands both to keep that water on the landscape longer, but then also to mitigate all these other damaging impacts that are happening from climate change.
Those wetlands that the beaver habitat create then can sequester carbon, can create these peat bogs, creating a place for sequestering atmospheric CO2, greenhouse gas emissions, which is a big topic. And so here we have an organism who works for free, who does it better than we can do it, who doesn't require permits, who makes babies and trains their own young how to do this, and they slow the flow, they recharge the water, they clean the water, they create fire refugia, they improve the drought resilience, the flood resilience, the fire resilience, make habitat, and people love to go see them, and they're watchable wildlife.
Much of the momentum for bringing back beavers is coming from the grassroots, from regular folks. Beavers need all the help they can get from citizen scientists, says Kate Lundquist.
We absolutely encourage citizen science because right now we don't actually know how many beaver we have and where they all are. And so through the iNaturalist program, which is run by California Academy of Sciences, there's a great way that people can make observations. And so you can do it on your smartphone and just upload observations of signs of beaver, chewed sticks, dams, the beaver themselves, if you're lucky enough to find some. They do generally come out only at night or in the sunset and sunrise hours, the crepuscular times. I love that word. So that's really helpful for us, knowing where the beaver are, and then also just really getting the word out about these different strategies. So if you know of neighbors or if you yourself are having problems, if you have a conflict with a beaver, then let us know and we want to connect you with the resources and the information of how to implement these coexistence strategies.
That grassroots impetus is also leading to actual state policy change and funding. The campaign has even gotten beavers their own lobbyist.
So, just want to remind everyone that we are all keystone species, and we too have impacts on the ecosystems that we're living in, and we can disturb them in a way that's regenerative, or we can disturb them in a way that's destructive. And the more we can learn from our allies like beaver and all of our other allies out there, the more we can show up in a way that is, in fact, more regenerative.
Kate Lundquist and Brock Dolman, working with nature to heal nature. Beaver Believers, how to restore planet water. Executive producer Kenny Ossabell. Written by Kenny Ossabell. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Production assistants, Monica Lopez. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 260.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
Every morning, he wakes at 4:30, and every morning, I wonder how he does it. It's April, and I hear the familiar sounds of the zipping of the fleece jacket and the whirr of the kettle boiling. Not for the luxury of a coffee, but to thaw the frozen dew from the Jeep window. The dog, long attuned to this routine, rises from her slumber and dances around his feet as he pulls his wellies on and steps out into the morning chill. Lambing season is here. Lambing season sounds delightful, doesn't it? Green pastures speckled with fuzzy newborn lambs prancing about on wobbly legs. Spring, the season of new life and nature at its most bountiful. Well, that's not the full story. Lambing, for a farmer, means late nights in bitterly cold sheds, coaxing stubborn ewes into motherhood, rubbing warmth into quivering creatures. It's evening calls to the man who has the cure for the farmyard pox known as ORF, or summoning neighbours for help with a birthing crisis. It's a brutal combination of sleep deprivation, sodden clothing, fleeting victories, and fated losses. And yet, some people just take to it. My partner is one of those people. He's not sentimental about it. He doesn't gush over his lambs or give them names. He doesn't pretend this is anything but business. Still though, when I see him tending to a newborn lamb who has arrived weak and limp, I notice his air of determination that says, defeat is not an option. He'll mutter profanity at it, which I imagine is some kind of motivational technique. Then, with luck, the lamb's drooping body will pulse and it'll kick out. He'll place it tenderly under the glow of the heat lamp and wait to make sure the mother accepts it. Then move on without any more fuss. Barely even a look of satisfaction on his face. Just another job done. I recognise this calibre of man. Years ago, on a different farm in Wexford, there was another man who moved through life in much the same way, without a need for fanfare, my father. He was a dairy farmer, and I remember the subtle strength of a man who rarely exhibited joy, who seemed at his most relaxed amidst hardship. Only now, watching my partner, can I begin to understand the appeal of this farming life. Sitting still is not natural for these men. The idle pleasures that most of us enjoy, a lie-in, a holiday, are wasted on them. Their peace is found in routine and work. The harder, the better. Lambing happens in all weather, and in Ireland, that usually means the worst weather. Fields transform to sludge, winds batter shed doors, and the occasional bit of snow can arrive in time to make a testing task that bit more testing. Yet these farmers don't complain. I am in awe of their resilience. This is a kind of stoicism of character that goes back centuries. Maybe you could call it mindfulness, finding calm, thriving even, in work that is repetitive, physical, and unyielding. My partner may not talk much about his emotions, but he works them out through aching muscles and calloused hands, through the steady rhythm of feeding lambs and surveying their mothers. The worries and troubles of life are all poured into the labour. Of course, the work also takes its toll. Lambing can break a person in small ways or big, from complete exhaustion to being overwhelmed by the burden of too much loss. Though many lambs will flourish, others will slip away, too weak to survive, and all those hours of effort amount to nothing. No time to be down about it, he surrenders with a frown, toots, wipes his hands, onto the next one. And thus, for 6 weeks, he functions on minimal sleep, pulls on the same frayed jumper and the same batter coat, and eats whatever is handed to him in whatever few moments he can steal. Sometimes I think I should worry about him, but then I see him, stressed out, dog-tired, but totally himself. Not happy, exactly. Happiness and farming don't seem to go hand in hand. But fulfilled. And I suppose that's enough.
In 1996, I went to Beirut for a fortnight to visit my sister. It was September, the pines in the hills crispy after a long summer, the beach clubs along the coast still open. We ate meze and sticky barbecued meat on the terrace of an Ottoman palace in the Shouf Mountains, where the only other diners were Druze leader Walid Jumblat and several hundred Syrian Boy Scouts. We sat by the altar in the Temple of Bacchus at Baalbek, waiting for the sonic booms of Israeli jets and Hezbollah anti-aircraft fire to end so the guide could resume our tour. We went to Damascus on a coach. We didn't realise until we were standing in front of a stone step that was weeping the tears of Christ that we were on the Maronite Christian equivalent of a day trip to Knock. Lebanon was broken and chaotic and achingly beautiful, and I didn't want to go home. I stayed for 2 years. I found a job. There were lots of people like me in Beirut in those days, brought there by the opportunities offered by the rebuilding of the city after years of war. At the weekends, we met in English-style taverns and Irish pubs and compared notes on the insane driving and the parasitic infections our delicate stomachs were prey to. We complained, but really we loved the place. There were other workers, men from Syria and India who waited on street corners at dawn, hoping to be picked for a day's labouring on one of the thousands of construction sites. An army of women in pink gingham housecoats, women from Sri Lanka and the Philippines and Africa who were employed as domestic servants. From early morning, you could see them on apartment balconies, hanging out washing, wiping dust from French doors, squeezing out mops. It still shames me that we were called expats while they were referred to as migrant workers. At Christmas, I stayed in Lebanon as I could only get one day off, the 25th. This was more than compensated for when it came to Easter, of which there were three: Roman Catholic, Maronite, and Greek Orthodox. The butcher on the corner put live chicks dyed in the pastel shades of sugared almonds in a cage outside his shop, and for three Sundays in a row, bells rang out across the hills. I came home to Ireland the following year, promising myself I'd go back one day. It took nearly 20 years. When we got off the plane, the air was warm and mildly fetid, and my sister and her husband were waiting. I felt as though I'd never left. We found ourselves in a convoy of rusty, overcrowded buses that were driving two abreast and overtaking on hairpin bends above sheer valleys. They were packed with women and girls who had their arms thrust out the windows, beating out a rhythm on the roofs and singing at the top of their voices. One of the buses hit a car, and when the police came, they ordered the passengers out. The girls stood at the side of the road in long white robes, a black cross marked on their foreheads like Catholics on Ash Wednesday. They were celebrating Mescal, the Ethiopian festival that commemorates the finding of the true cross. Ethiopian Christians believe that Helena, the Roman queen, had a revelation in a dream. She was told to make a huge fire and that its smoke would show her where the true cross was buried. The people of Jerusalem brought wood and made a vast bonfire. They doused it in frankincense and set it alight. The smoke rose high in the sky, settling on the ground precisely where the cross had been buried. The Mescal national holiday had been a couple of days earlier in Ethiopia, and the women had waited until Sunday, their only day off, to have their own celebration in the mountains above Beirut, which were dotted with Christian shrines in dusty glass cases. We had a long lunch in a garden overlooking vineyards and olive groves, and when we left, the roads were quieter. Later that evening, we saw one of the girls. She was standing by herself in the centre of Place Sassine, a busy roundabout in the city, cars and taxis spinning around her. She hoisted her white robe an inch and dashed through the traffic amidst angry shouts and the honking of horns. Back to an apartment balcony and a pink gingham housecoat, the white robe folded away until next year.
Thank you. The less said about Samuel Beckett, the better. I mean this as the highest compliment. A writer who pared down words to their essence, who mined the dark treasures found in silence, and who wrote a stage work lasting 35 seconds, would not have appreciated garrulous elegies. To the many thousands of words written about him since his death in 1989, he would have listened with a wry smile, but surely without a response. In college, we revered him. This was the Irishman who had written the most famous play of our time, Waiting for Godot, in a copybook from the front to the back, and then turning the copybook around from the back to the front. And he had written this existential masterpiece in French. His picture looked down eagle-like from the wall of our flat in Dublin, alongside that of Che Guevara. Sam Beckett was born on this day in 1906. At our age, he had been an accomplished cricketer, playing with distinction for Trinity. He was also good at tennis and, allegedly, bar billiards. He moved to Paris to teach English in the late 1920s, where he became Joyce's friend and amanuensis. But when he turned away from the advances of Lucia, Joyce's daughter, the friendship between the two men cooled. In 1938, in Paris, coming home one night from the cinema, Beckett was stabbed in the chest by a pimp and nearly died. He subsequently met his attacker in court and asked him why he had stabbed him. "I don't know, sir. I'm sorry," the man replied. Beckett was so struck by the randomness of the pimp's response, which seemed to encapsulate his own view of the absurdity of human existence, that he declined to press charges. During the Second World War, he fought with valour in the French resistance, for which he was awarded the Croix de Guerre, but later dismissed his time in action as Boy Scout stuff. He seldom gave interviews and shunned the limelight. His inaccessibility was part of his legend. And so it was one late spring afternoon in the 1980s, I was sitting in a cafe in Paris, up behind the Sorbonne, killing time before I met a friend, when I looked out and, as a thud hit my chest, saw him coming up the street. There was no doubt. The tall, slim frame, the stooped gait, the spiky hair, the chiselled features, the face that had looked down at us from the wall in our flat in Dublin. Our hero. And now here he was, almost level with where I sat. The next thing I knew, I had fallen into step beside him and we proceeded up the pavement together. Breathless with awe, not quite sure of what I was doing, but giddy with excitement, I conveyed my admiration. Beckett inclined his head of famously close-cut grey hair in patient but gracious acknowledgement. Having read somewhere that he followed the activities of the Irish rugby team, I launched into an uninvited analysis of the then dire state of Irish rugby. He looked at me imperiously and then nodded, which I took as a sign that he agreed with my conclusions. We halted for a traffic light. He was taller than me by an inch. He was wearing a jacket of black and white herringbone tweed and a scarf. The light went green. We crossed together, step for step, and I, starstruck, gabbled on about God knows what until the next light loomed. It was then I took out paper and pen and asked for his autograph. Beckett drew up and peered at me. "Oh, Christ," I thought. "I've done it now." But no, he took the paper and pen and, doubling the paper, very slowly wrote his name. "Thank you very much, Mr. Beckett," I said, and added, "Lovely day, isn't it?" He smiled. "Lovely," he said, and walked on. I was thinking of him recently when I read that a cryptocurrency billionaire, someone who has made his money from trading in something that doesn't actually exist, had paid more than $6 million at an art auction for a banana taped to a wall. The purchaser later ate the banana. I don't think Sam Beckett would have been in the least surprised. He presented us with the basic absurdity of the human condition and, in his sparing words, made us acknowledge with a graveyard smile that he was merely telling us what we already know.
I was 13 when I first encountered Lucy. I suspected she was of similar age, but she seemed much more mature. Ours was a slightly strained relationship. We tiptoed about each other, shrouded in an atmosphere of great suspicion. Our choreography was, to say the least, cautious. It was summertime and I had been given my first responsible job. The position came with its own transport and involved travel. Lucy, you see, was the donkey used to haul a cartload of milk churns to the creamery. Our journey couldn't begin until I first caught the ass where she grazed in her paddock. She had an ability to ignore any unwanted visitors to our realm with all the skill of a tired barman at closing time. I discovered that the sound of a handful of oats being rattled in an enamel basin might sometimes catch her attention. Once the winkers were over her head, the pantomime of harnessing could commence. Lucy could make the process very awkward. With hames and collar, straddle and belly band in place, we could proceed to the next stage. The task of reversing her between the shafts of the cart offered a showcase for her real stubborn streak. When I needed to move her in one direction, she twisted the opposite way, making sure that she trod on my feet during the process. I sometimes caught my mother watching the proceedings from the farmhouse window, and I couldn't but notice the grin on her face. Eventually, we got started on our 3-mile journey to the creamery. Pace was dictated by Lucy. No amount of encouragement could alter her sway-backed amble. I needed to keep constant connection with her via the reins. Whenever she thought my concentration had wandered, she merely stopped to munch on the nice things she noticed growing in the long acre beside the roadway. She seemed to have a preference for chickweed, vetch and Queen Anne's lace. The roadway was tarred. On hot days, the tar would blister and pop like bubblegum beneath the iron bands of the wheels. It was a slow and noisy odyssey. Over time, I found it was useless to urge Lucy away from our roadside treats. She made it clear that she had never agreed to this undertaking in the first place, and this was her way of reclaiming dignity and ownership. There were 3 filled milk churns in the cart. On the journey to the creamery, I was conscious of a sloshing noise emanating from the cans. It seemed to have a soporific quality that lent itself to daydreaming, and believe me, Lucy took full advantage of any lack of attention thus induced. On the morning of my first working day, we joined the snaking procession of carts and tractors outside the creamery. I watched the procedure and the protocol involved. The cart needed to be reversed up to the loading bay and the lids removed from the churns so that they might be manhandled by the creamery staff. Lucy refused to cooperate. She moved in every direction other than reverse. Then, when I finally had the cart in situ, I discovered I did not have the strength to remove the big churn lids. The action of the sloshing milk had created a form of vacuum and welded them stuck. With red-faced embarrassment, I finally called for help from the smirking strongmen. Lucy picked that moment to bellow out a hee-haw that some might construe as laughter. It's a humiliation that is still almost too painful to recall. Our journey home with three now empty churns was a slightly different affair. Lucy possessed a homing instinct that would put any sat-nav software to shame. The minute we turned for home, she set off at an exhilarating gallop. We rattled and rolled. Lucy pulled back her ears, leaving a brief trail of dust in our wake. But you know the saying, and I can verify that it's true, short and sweet like an ass's gallop. That initial burst of speed was all the donkey wished to deliver. Within a few minutes, it was back to roadside grazing for her and more daydreaming for me. I was beginning to understand how the summer with Lucy was shaping up. I thought about her in recent times. On television news bulletins, there are frequent images from the Middle East showing stoic donkeys carrying bewildering loads of bewildered people through bewildering landscapes. There's no vetch or chickweed or Queen Anne's lace, no verdant pasture, but still the donkeys plod on. However, their role was not always so ignominious. On a glorious occasion, one of their kind carried a man in triumph through the streets of Jerusalem. Palm fronds were tossed beneath the donkey's hooves to soften its journey. Because of who they carried, it is said that each ass wears a branded cross on its back by way of reward. It took me a long time to realize Lucy knew something I was unaware of, and that at the end of the day, she was a lot cleverer than me.
Take me back to my boots and saddle.
Ooh. On a windy spring day, I stand on a rocky shore with my back to Galway Bay, staring at a low sandy cliff. Halfway up, there's an irregular line of holes which I'm attempting to count. 30, 35, maybe 40 in all. All summer long, the sky here is alive with chittering, dancing birds, looping and twisting and spiralling. For the holes are the nests of sand martins, the small brown and white cousins of swallows. Each pair of martins digs out a burrow close to their neighbours and lays a clutch of eggs inside. Once the chicks have hatched, the parent birds dart continuously in and out, catching gnats and flies to feed to their hungry brood. After a few weeks, the fledglings are strong enough to stretch their young wings and launch themselves into the air from their high homes, learning to fend for themselves. Today, the cliff is quiet and empty. There's not enough food to sustain the birds over an Irish winter. So last September, they set off on their long journey south, flying over France and Spain, across the Mediterranean and the Sahara, to the lands of West and Central Africa. And there they stay, feeding but not nesting, until they feel the call to fly all the way north again, arriving back at the same beach they left months ago. It's an annual round trip of about 12,000 miles, yet a sand martin is small enough to fit in the palm of your hand. For centuries, people wondered where birds like swallows and martins disappeared to in winter. The Greek philosopher Aristotle suggested that they hibernated in trees or in crevices in rocks. In the 16th century, a Swedish priest concluded that swallows spent the winter in the mud at the bottom of lakes. It's likely he came to this conclusion after watching the birds swooping low over the water, fattening up on insects shortly before they vanished at the end of summer. A few decades later, an English minister and naturalist called Charles Morton hypothesized that the birds flew to the moon, estimating that this would take them 60 days. It wasn't until something strange happened in rural Germany in the 19th century that people began to understand the real story of bird migration. Every spring, pairs of handsome white storks returned to the village of Klutz to build their large twiggy nests on tall trees in the church tower. In 1822, the villagers noticed a very odd bird. It had something lodged in its body that looked like a long, thin stick. The lower end protruded below its shoulder. The centre part was hidden inside the bird's neck, and the top extended up beyond its head. It's not on record how the stork died, but when it was examined, the locals realised the object was a beautifully crafted wooden arrow with a small triangular tip. No local people hunted with bows and arrows, so where did it come from? Eventually, someone identified the wood of the shaft. It was from an African tree. A hunter in a far-off country had shot the bird, which had not only miraculously survived, but had been strong enough to obey its migratory instinct and fly all the way to Germany with an arrow through its neck. It was named the Pfeilstork, the arrow stork, and was stuffed and put on display at the University of Rostock as the first substantial evidence that birds migrated over long distances. Understanding of these extraordinary journeys gradually expanded, helped by better telescopes and developments such as bird ringing, invented by a teacher in Denmark at the turn of the 20th century. Today, the science of seasonal migration is global, digital, and highly sophisticated. Researchers attach tiny GPS transmitters to birds' wings and monitor them with satellites. Radar networks track migratory movements, and citizen scientists around the world upload their observations into international databases. Yet it still feels miraculous that swallows and martins, corncrakes and cuckoos, and so many other birds have evolved to make such astonishing annual trips. And it's with a sense of excited anticipation that I return to the rocky shore every late spring, scanning the cliff and the sky for the returning sand martins, until I can call out happily, "They're back."
Same swallows whooping, sooner brings the season, sooner brings the season of when on white blossom.
Scullion, or Song of the Blackbird. This is Grandmother's story, or at least some of it. Nora's story, the latter part of a long life and towards the end. Knowing her and loving her for her gentle kindliness has left deep feelings of loss and a sense of how committed to this world an old woman of her generation might have been. To be in the flesh means, at times, to be in darkness. To be on her knees, for instance, as I often noticed her, searching in the cupboard under the sink for a rag or a feather duster, being scullion. Once she found a large grey rat, mad alive, trapped in the wire cage she had baited with cheese. She screeched and shoved it with her foot, cage and all, in under the base of the dust-dark pantry tall boy. In the privy, out in the corner field, a hole in the galvanized admitted a pencil of light that drew a line across the right-hand wall. She kept neat squares cut from newspapers, and sometimes in almost under